Eiji Aonuma, and I work in the Software Production Department of Entertainment Analysis and Development, or EAD, at Nintendo Company Limited. For roughly 8 years, I've been doing work related to a game known as Zelda, but I never imagined that an opportunity for me to talk to all of you about this experience would ever come. I was very surprised when the opportunity arose, and at the same time, I was incredibly honored. So allow me to outline for you the topics that I'll be speaking about today regarding the evolution of the Legend of Zelda franchise. I'll start by introducing to you, in order, the numerous titles in the series that have appeared since the birth of the first Zelda game. Next, I will explain how Zelda has changed over the years. Then my main theme today being behind the scenes in franchise evolution, I'll talk about just what it means to be Zelda-esque, or what is Zelda-ness. And finally, I'll talk about approaches to evolving the franchise. I'm sure that many of you who are here today are familiar with the Zelda series, but since some of you may not be, I'd like to take a look back at Zelda's history. Let's start by taking a look at each of the Zelda games in the order they were released. To comprehend the flow of the series, please take a look at this timeline. The numbers listed under sales represent worldwide sales for each title. The units are in thousands of units sold. This list starts with the release of the Nintendo Entertainment System in 1985, 19 years ago, and 2 years after its launch in Japan. This marked the beginning of all Nintendo video game products, not just Zelda. 2 years after that, in 1987, we saw the now-celebrated release of the first title in the Zelda series, The Legend of Zelda, unveiling the top-down viewpoint. This was followed up the next year with the 1988 release of The Adventure of Link, a more action-oriented Zelda with side-scrolling areas. You may notice a red asterisk by The Adventure of Link in this list. This marks the year that I joined Nintendo, which technically means that Zelda has seniority over me at Nintendo. In 1991, we released the Super Nintendo Entertainment System, and followed that a year later with the release of The Legend of Zelda, A Link to the Past, on that system. With this title, the Zelda series once again returned to the top-down isometric view. But it can probably be said that were it not for this title, the Zelda franchise would never have developed. It established many of the conventions of Zelda games to come, including those that were refined in The Legend of Zelda Link's Awakening, which was released for the Game Boy the following year. Even now, Link's Awakening is lauded as a quintessential isometric Zelda game, and it was remade in full color in 1998 for the Game Boy Color. Finally, in 1998 came the game that revolutionized the Zelda series, taking the top-down 2D series into full 3D. The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time refined the 3D camera of Super Mario 64, allowed players to target enemies, and created a smooth 3D sword fighting experience, strengthening the appeal of the Z button on the N64 controller and selling 7.6 million units worldwide. It was after this 3D Zelda title that I was put in charge of the series, so when I talk in detail about development shortly, I'll be talking mainly about Majora's Mask, which was released 2 years after Ocarina, and the platform change to GameCube and subsequent release of The Wind Waker. So in 2004, we've seen that the Zelda series has developed into top-down style games on the handheld Game Boy Advance, and into full 3D style games on home consoles like the Nintendo GameCube. But This year, we will see the release of the multiplayer GameCube game Four Swords Adventures, a game that links the Game Boy Advance to the Nintendo GameCube for a top-down game that takes advantage of a 3D engine on the GameCube, allowing for 2.5D artistic expression. So with this new expressive quality, and with the upcoming release of the unique Nintendo DS system, I think we'll see more changes coming to the franchises, the likes of which we can talk more about at this year's E3, when we also talk about developments with the Wind Waker 2. That covers my discussion of the history of the Zelda series, but in addition to the games I've listed here, are others that cannot be left out when speaking about Zelda. Please take a look. What you just saw were two Zelda titles developed by other creators after my involvement with Zelda began. The first was Super Smash Bros. Melee, and I'm sure you're all aware that this was developed under the direction of Masahiro Sakurai, who is also speaking here at GDC this year. The second was Soul Calibur 2, which was planned in collaboration with Namco, and which featured Link as an exclusive playable character in the GameCube version. While I was not directly involved in the development of these titles, both teams were extremely careful with how they handled the Zelda characters and universe, and their work led to even further expansion and development of the Zelda franchise. In planning collaborations like these and the Capcom-developed Oracle games for Game Boy, which were listed in the timeline, there can be difficulties in fitting the direction the creators wish to take into the existing Zelda universe. And there is the risk that the collaboration will feel forced, or even worse, that it will negatively affect the franchise. But allowing other talent to develop new possibilities for Zelda games is a very important development for the series. That covers the major developments in the Zelda franchise from past until present. So if this is our background, I'll now begin a simple explanation of my involvement with Zelda and my work on the Zelda team. My first encounter with Zelda came in 1988, shortly after I joined Nintendo. After studying design in college, I began work designing a variety of pixel characters. At the time, I didn't have much experience playing games, and I was particularly bad at playing games that required quick reflexes. So immediately after I started playing the original Zelda, I failed to read the movements of the Octoroks that appeared in the field, and my game suddenly came to an end. Even after getting used to the controls, Each time the screen scrolled to a new area, new Octoroks appeared, and I thought, am I ever going to have to fight these things? Am I going to have to fight these things forever? Eventually, I gave up getting any further in the game. The result was that I was left with the impression that The Legend of Zelda was not a game that suited me. So what kind of games did suit me? Those would be text-based adventures. To someone like me who enjoyed reading stories, these were games that let you actively participate in the story and let you experience the joy of seeing your own thoughts and actions affect the progression of the story. Plus, these games don't require fast reflexes and thus are games that don't require gaming skills. So I thought that if I was going to make games, I'd want to make this type of game. After that, I spent my days drawing pixel art of Mario and Peach and honing my design skills on a variety of projects. Then in 1991, I came in contact with a new Zelda game called A Link to the Past. Although I'd been frustrated intended by the original Legend of Zelda. Since I knew the graphical display improvements of the Super NES, I knew A Link to the Past was a game that I had to play, even if I quit halfway through. In playing A Link to the Past, I kept repeating very basic actions that were completely unrelated to battling enemies. Things like cutting the grass, lifting stones to search beneath them, and using keys to open doors. In these, I discovered reliable methods for proceeding through the game, and I got the same feeling I did when using command inputs to actively participate in the story of a text-based adventure. And yet, I realized that those same feelings were coupled with a sense of play control response that far exceeded what I could experience with command input alone. This and realizing the types of control response that you could get while still forwarding on, pushing through the story, I realized that this was the type of game that I really wanted to create. But unfortunately, at that time, Nintendo still had need of my role as a designer, so my hope to create a Zelda-like game could not be immediately realized. 2 years later, though, there was a project that gave me just such an opportunity. It was 1996, and the game that was released in the overlap between the SNES and the N64. And for a variety of reasons, the game was not localized, and so did not make it to the worldwide market. But this game called Marvelous was built upon the Zelda style of adventure events, and was praised in Japan as an ambitious work that felt like a change-up to the Zelda style of gameplay. I've never asked Mr. Miyamoto how he viewed this game, so I can't really make any claims about his thoughts on it, but it was after this game that he instructed me to join the team that was creating the next Zelda. I wasn't involved in Ocarina of Time from the initial stages of development, but rather joined from the point at which the planning framework had already been finalized and work was beginning on building onto that framework. This project started off with multiple directors responsible for individual portions of the game, which was a different style from the way EAD had developed software until then. I was mainly responsible for dungeon design and design of enemy creatures in the dungeons. Of course, it was strange that I, who was so terrible at fighting enemies in the original Legend of Zelda, and decided that Zelda was not the game for me, ended up being in charge of enemy design. But the type of gameplay used in enemy battles becomes an extremely important element of dungeon design, so there was really no way for me to escape it. In Ocarina of Time, in addition to doing the dungeon design, I also took on the challenge of incorporating adventure elements into dungeon design, by which I mean giving each dungeon some type of theme, such as rescuing trapped Gorons or hunting down and defeating the Poe sisters. After finishing work on Ocarina of Time, Mr. Miyamoto instructed us to use the Ocarina of Time engine to create Ura Zelda, a very Zelda series, typical Zelda series second version with rearranged dungeon gameplay. But I felt that just changing around the puzzle solving without changing the overall structure of the game would be too limiting. So I turned down Mr. Miyamoto's offer and proposed that if anything, I wanted to make a new Zelda game. Now, Ura Zelda was to have been developed for the Nintendo 64 disk system that was released only in Japan, but since I turned down this project, other staff members developed it, and it was finally coupled with the GameCube version of Ocarina and released as the Master Quest. So even now, Mr. Miyamoto still scolds me for being the lazy type of guy who comes to conclusions before even giving something a try. held the title. I wasn't thinking that I would be the director, but under Mr. Miyamoto's instruction, we were to create a new Zelda game with a focus on its game system, and we were to complete the game in a short period of time using the Ocarina engine. So it was necessary for someone who had been responsible for bringing together all the details of Ocarina's game spec handle the overall design of the new game, and that role was given to me. Mr. Miyamoto's goal of completing a new game in a short period of time was a result of having spent so much time developing the 3D Ocarina engine, and he wanted to make effective use of that engine in creating a new game. While we decided this would be very important for future Zelda development, we were faced with the very difficult question of just what kind of a game could follow up Ocarina of Time and its worldwide sales of 7 million units. In response to this challenge, we came up with the idea that the solutions to puzzles would be found in a series of recurring events. We adopted a 3-day time system. This 3-day system of Majora's Mask introduced players to a variety of events that occurred at the same time over this period of 3 days that the player played through multiple times. And once all the puzzles were solved, then the hidden goal appeared. With the system, it was possible to make the game data more compact while still providing deep gameplay. Now, of course, designing all the matters and events that were governed by this 3-day period proposed new challenges and thus led us to a number of new discoveries. Now, before creating Majora's Mask, there was actually one new type of expression that we began considering, but weren't able to accomplish on the N64. With the emergence of the GameCube platform, we now had the power we needed, and we went back in this direction. This was the toon shading graphical style of the Wind Waker, which we completed in 2002. We decided in advance that the story in The Wind Waker would start with Link being young and unfold from there. But we felt that there was an unnatural feeling to using a more evolved version of the realistic Ocarina model to tell the story of a child. So that led us to instead adopt the toon shading graphics technique. We all had great expectations for evoking new game ideas out of this new style. The result of this was to use the main character's impressive eyes in a new focus system and increase the game's action elements with improved sword fighting. In the end, I feel I can boast that with the new visual style and new game ideas such as these, we were able to push the franchise in a pioneering new direction and further expand the Zelda universe. Now, that explanation was a little long, but it covers my encounters with the franchise and some important points in game development. The result of this is that I now work as a producer overseeing all Zelda development. I have inherited this role from Mr. Miyamoto, but the situation is more one of me being a producer who is closer to the development team, with Mr. Miyamoto remaining the ultimate producer who has final say over all things Zelda. So that process has not changed. But this leads us to my next topic, which is a very important theme for today, and that is the all-important question that Mr. Miyamoto always instructs us on, and that is, what does it mean to be Zelda-esque? The first thing I want to tell you about in my discussion of Zelda-esqueness is an extremely important process that is inseparably connected to Zelda development, and that is something I call the Miyamoto test. Also known as upending the tea table. The Tabudai tea table is a low dining table in which you sit on the floor to eat at. But you don't see them often nowadays, as most Japanese families eat at Western-style dining tables. But when I was growing up in the 1950s through the 1970s, every house had one. So what it means to upend the tea table actually comes from a scene from a famous Japanese manga called Star of the Giants, in which the father, seated in back there on the left, hits his son in front of him so hard that the food on the table is knocked up into the air. Now, the father, being in no mood to eat what's been served, upended the table, forcing his wife to cook a new meal. This action by the head of the household was absolute and represents the action of an old-fashioned Japanese father. Of course, nowadays, if someone was to do that, it would actually destroy the family, and the father would be arrested for child abuse. So all that remains today is this phrase of upending the tea table. So long ago, there was a period where, in Japan, they thought this was proper and acceptable. Nowadays, with only the phrase remaining, generally what happens is the leader figure takes on the role of the strong, proper father. Whenever a game nears completion, with only the final polishing remaining, without fail, Mr. Miyamoto upends our tea table, and the direction that we all thought we were going in suddenly changes dramatically. But Mr. Miyamoto doesn't just upend the tea table and send the team into utter confusion. He then sits down with us, and together we rethink what we have done that has been effective and what we can do that will create a positive result for a Zelda game. So Mr. Miyamoto always says that when it comes to upending the tea table, I always pick up my own plate. So his test is very important, and it is something that we actually welcome. Lately, there is a phrase that Mr. Miyamoto mentions that speaks to the very nature of the Zelda series. That phrase is, Zelda is a game that values reality over realism. In the art world, realism is a movement to faithfully replicate the real world to whatever extent possible. Reality, though, is not mimicking the real world, but rather attempting to make players feel like what they are experiencing is real. The big difference is that even using more exaggerated expression, like toon shading, can be an effective means of making things feel more real. So what exactly is this Zelda reality that Mr. Miyamoto talks about? The next image is one scene that represents that reality. Shop in the Wind Waker. Let's take another look at it. Now, if I explain this scene in detail, first we see the bomb shop shopkeeper. Now, as you can see from the movie, he's got kind of a weird-looking face, but other than that, he's a normal guy. Next, Link comes. In response to Link's arrival, the shopkeeper says, "Welcome," or in this case, "This is the bomb shop." Which, so far, this is the general flow of shopping at any store, and there's nothing special about it. But I think there may be some here who notice that this scene occurs in the middle of the night, and Link is just a child. Which means that, technically, this scene fails the Miyamoto test. But then what would the correct answer be? Well, we're fine up to the point where Link enters the shop and speaks to the shopkeeper. It's the shopkeeper's response that must change. Are you alone, kid? Where are your parents? This is a bomb shop. This is no place for kids to come in the middle of the night. You be a good kid now. You be a good kid now and run on home. Well, that's what I should say. But the thing is, these pirates came and stole my bomb, so business hasn't been good lately. So I tell you what, I'll sell you bombs if you promise not to cause any trouble for my shop. This type of response from the shopkeeper would pass the Miyamoto test. And of course, when I tell you this, I'm sure some of you may think, it's Nintendo, of course. They want to make sure they remind people of what's proper. But that's really not the point. The important point here is that people who have been playing the game for a long time tend to forget that Link is just a child on an adventure towards some sort of objective. You know, in playing through the game, there's no need to be aware of Link's age, or really what his ultimate goal is. But when this happens, the things that the player is doing simply tend to become typical game actions, and the awareness that the player is just playing a game becomes stronger. So, of course, you know, players who need bombs to progress through the game, but don't happen to have any, will by chance find themselves visiting the bomb shop in the middle of the night. So when the shopkeeper says, "Hey, you're just a boy," the player, who had not been consciously thinking that Link was a boy, realizes, "Oh, that's right. I'm just a boy." The player then reflects on the fact that he is walking around in the middle of the night and starts to feel the loneliness of the middle of the night. That leads the player to becoming at one with the game world, and the player experiences reality. Now, let me just show you one more example. Now allow me to explain this scene in detail. First, the player has an object that he thinks he might be able to destroy. He puts a bomb there. The bomb explodes. This results in the wall breaking and the room ahead being revealed. Now, there is a start and an end to the explosion. There are several frames from the start of the kaboom to the explosion until the smoke blurring your view. The player still does not know for sure what has happened. Once the smoke is cleared, the player can see the result. Now, this is the time where we hear the now famous Zelda success chime. Now, the purpose of this chime is to inform the player that he has solved a puzzle. So in the scene we just saw, the sound was timed at the start of the explosion. This also miserably fails the Miyamoto test. Please look at the correct answer. same type of scene, this time from the Wind Waker. Were you able to catch the difference between this scene and the one from Ocarina? In the Ocarina scene, the success chime was heard before the explosion ended. Now, although this chime is supposed to indicate success, it is heard before the player realizes the result of his action, and thus does not feel that the reality that his actions were the correct answer. Instead, they feel like a mere game mechanic. Now, in the Wind Waker scene, the success chime was moved to play at this point in time. This way, the player has some idea of the results of his action when the success chime is heard, and as a result, the player gets the feeling that he accomplished something. This is reality. Now, the Zelda success chime is one element of Zelda-esqueness that has been carried on throughout the entire series. But if we just think we can insert it whenever, it becomes a negative rather than a positive. So this is one example of the types of mistakes that developers who have grown accustomed to developing Zelda games can make. Now, I think these examples may give you a bit of an understanding of Zelda reality, but these are primarily what we consider to be production techniques, and are really quite trivial in relation to gameplay. But Zelda reality is built by piling on these trivial elements, for these are what draw players into the game world. So this begs the question of whether or not we should apply these trivial details to all areas of game. But the answer is no. There are countless areas where we must remove elements of reality for the sake of gameplay. So in considering implementing production techniques, what's important is not adding them everywhere, but instead adding them with effective timing, and anticipating how players are going to play the game and how they will interpret different moments helps determine this timing, such as the bomb shop example above. Of course, trying to think about how players will interpret what you are creating while you are creating it is extremely difficult, and as to whether or not game developers can do so objectively is also difficult to answer. So how then do we assure that in the end, Zelda reality is maintained in a Zelda-esque way? The answer to that is to allow outside testers to play the finished game, and then we, the developers, stand behind them and watch their reactions. Another option is to ask the opinion of a producer who is separated from the actual development team. This is why I think the Miyamoto test will continue to be an important one for us. But at the same time, I get very frustrated that I did not notice sooner the things that Mr. Miyamoto notices. So it is my objective to eventually be able to look at Zelda from the same perspective that Mr. Miyamoto does. In the few Zelda titles that I've had my hand in, I've always tried to establish a new theme that guides the gameplay. Now, we feel that if we were to continue doing the same things, simply because Zelda has succeeded in the marketplace as a franchise, it'd only be a matter of time before people grew tired of the series, and Zelda would have its place in the video game world stolen by some other revolutionary title. Even more importantly, though, as creators, it wouldn't be any fun to simply continue making the same thing over and over again. We have continued creating new Zelda titles over the last few years without changing our core team members. Creating the next installment with the same team as the last can lead to barriers caused by a conformity of ideas. But being able to take the regrets of the last title and make them a theme for the next is extremely effective and leads us to decisions related to change and continuity. Zelda games, since Ocarina, we have continued to make use of the targeting camera that always focuses on the axis that links the player character to the target. The reason we've made this decision is because we've decided that this patently Zelda-esque camera allows players the smoothest control of their character in a 3D environment, and thus should not be changed. Instead, we have continued to tune this system to ease gameplay even more with each new installment. Also, since our objective in displaying the button controls for the actions the player can perform via the action icons that appear on screen is to give players guidance on solving puzzles, which have become more difficult in 3D, we have continued using this action icon system as well. Now, it's true that we changed the entire game system in Majora's Mask into a 3-day time system. But this idea actually stemmed from the thought that we could perhaps take the time passage system we introduced in Ocarina of Time and find a way to flesh it out more. And likewise, the idea of turning the main field of play in the Wind Waker into a vast ocean that players traverse by boat started with the idea of presenting players with a new type of movement to enjoy that would be different from the horse-based movement of Epona in Ocarina of Time. So even the changes that we do implement often come from ideas for improving and expanding elements found in previous installments. Now, probably the most representative example of a change made without consciously thinking about a past installment would be the tune shading of the Wind Waker. But as I explained before, we thought this was the best style suited to a younger Link, and our objective was to develop this into new game ideas. So it could be said that even this was changed from the last installment in pursuit of more reality. Basically, most of the things that we try to change in new Zelda games come from experiences developing and improvements in expansions on past Zelda games, or what I like to call inevitable changes. Of course, the question of whether or not what the creators see as being inevitable or necessary changes will be considered so by the consumer is a difficult one to answer. But we think that as long as we're able to add new elements of fun without losing what was good about the last installment, then we believe that the new games will continue to be ones that Zelda fans are happy with. Now, this is a bit of a tangent, but can everyone here cook? If you can cook, please raise your hands. I personally am a bit of a glutton, so I actually like to both cook food and eat it. Now, cooking is interesting because I think it's something that anybody can try and immediately see the results of their efforts. It's a very friendly form of creative work. It may be difficult to understand, but when you stew ingredients together, they naturally release astringent flavors, bitter flavors, and other impurities into the stew. And so you have to skim these impurities off the top when stewing, because if you don't, the stew you are making will not be delicious. It's difficult to explain clearly, but generally if you're combining distinct flavors and textures, the stronger the taste or the flavor or texture, the more impurities or the more aku that come out when you mix these ingredients with other ingredients in the stew. On a side note, in Japan, we describe people with very colorful personalities as having a lot of aku. Now, even when you're making a game, mixing different ingredients together into one pot always produces aku. In games, the impurities are the elements that feel unnatural or out of place. And I think that making a good game or being a good chef means doing a good job of removing these impurities. By combining this slow and steady work of removing the impurities and adding in the spice, that is what Mr. Miyamoto calls Zelda reality, and then doing a good job of stewing in the occasional fresh ingredient is what maintains the deliciousness of Zelda and leads us to new evolutions in the franchise. I'm afraid that some of you have come here today. We're hoping to hear a more technical discussion, but the essence of the Zelda franchise is difficult to sum up in technical terms. So instead, I have tried to sum it up with my own open and honest impressions. But of course, since I've only been involved in three Zelda titles to date, I cannot say that I'm anywhere near having a complete and thorough knowledge of the Zelda universe. So going forward as producer, continuing to make the Zelda franchise into an even more stimulating one, if a time comes when I can talk to you about Zelda in slightly more technical terms, I would be more than happy to do so. Now finally, I want to show you something that was released in Japan last week and has been a huge hit with Zelda fans. You'll be seeing it at E3 this year. I'd like to show you The Legend of Zelda: Four Swords Adventures. Thank you very much.